welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'll be joined later in the show by my co-host, Jen Chavez. We have a slate of filmmakers and story midwives for you today. Our theme is down-to-earth documentaries, and we'll be joined on the phone by documentarian Todd Darling. He has a new documentary out. He's returning to KBOO with Occupy the Farm. It's been getting rave reviews. But first, we have on the line, we have Jen in the studio with story midwife Laura Loforti. She directs the NPMTC Vanport Multimedia Project and will be part of the Northwest Film Center's evening with community-based storytellers. Let's hear from Jen and Laura Loforti.
In less than 4 months in 1942, in the land between Portland and the Columbia River, the city of Vanport was hastily built to temporarily house an influx of wartime shipyard workers. Many of them were African Americans who were largely shut out of Portland by racist housing policies. It was the second largest city in Oregon and the largest federal public housing project in the nation, built on vulnerable reclaimed lowlands. And on a single afternoon in 1948, a flood and the breach of a dike put the whole city underwater, killing 15 people and displacing tens of thousands. A recent Smithsonian Magazine piece calls Vanport, both its construction and its demise, an integral chapter in Oregon's racist history. In fact, an NPR Code Switch story references, quote, "the time, nature, and racism teamed up to wipe out a whole city." The Vanport Multimedia Project, a project of the North Portland Multimedia Training Center and the Scanner Foundation, seeks to cull the oral histories of Vanport survivors, examining Vanport's enduring impact on Oregon and its residents. The center has offered media and story-gathering workshops for community members to record their own interviews with survivors. The project is part of an upcoming screening and panel discussion at the Northwest Film Center, an evening with community-based storytellers, coming up on April 10th at 7 p.m. It's part of the University of Oregon's What is Journalism Conference, exploring the changing nature of journalism in the modern age. Recently, I was joined by the Vanport Multimedia Project's program director, Laura Loforti, to discuss the project and participatory media making. Thank you for joining me, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
So your multimedia project is about the former city of Vanport in Oregon. Only 6 years after the city was built, the Vanport flood occurred in 1948. It wiped out the whole city from what it sounds like in a single afternoon. That flood has been compared by some to New Orleans Hurricane Katrina in 2005. How might one make that comparison?
From my understanding, there are similarities in the sense that there were really, one might wonder if other communities lived there, not just so much in terms of race, but just in terms of class, would have been different. Many of the people we interviewed said that they'd never received a note from the city saying that they should evacuate. There was a notice that actually said to be calm and not to worry, not to get excited, to quote the notice. One might wonder, many people question the way the evacuation was conducted and who was warned and who wasn't, and in general how the evacuation and the alarm went out. So there's definitely some comparison. It would be interesting to hear from people who went through both events what the comparisons are.
Well, people can certainly hear some of that insight through your project, the Vanport Multimedia Project. It reaches out to the community to record and produce interviews with older folks who actually lived in Vanport. What do you think can be achieved by crowdsourcing like this, oral histories and interviews in this participatory way, that can't be achieved by, say, a documentary or even by a single or small team of trained oral historians?
Well, I don't think there is a better or worse way to tell stories as long as we tell them. My background is actually in traditional journalism, traditional storytelling, and I always felt a little bit uncomfortable with the power dynamics of this relationship. Who tells the story, what stories, and how that story gets out. And to whom. So I'm a big believer in participatory practices in all my work. So I call myself a story midwife and not a journalist anymore. I always say I'm a recovering journalist. So in this case particularly, I feel the story has been told in a very incomplete way in the past. Often people, if they know anything about Vampire, they know about the flood, right? When there is the anniversary of the flood on Memorial Day, usually there is a little something on the newspapers, on the media outlet, and it's kind of about the flood mainly. And what I find is that including community members in kind of helping us understand what part of the story is missing or what part of the story they would like to hear and to preserve makes more of a like a richer story. It's not complete for sure, but it gives the community, the impacted community, the ability and the opportunity to complete the picture and to kind of shape the narrative in a way that is more truthful to them. One thing about telling stories, particularly about tragedies and struggles, is that when it's an outsider telling that story, we tend to gravitate towards the drama and again, the tragedy, which is, of course, a central part of the story. I find that when you include communities in telling their experience about that tragedy, their resilience emerges. And so I understand that there is a flood, but when we allow them to talk about how they came to Vamport, what brought them there, how was life there, how they built their community, and what happened afterwards, how they reconnected, how they rebuild their communities. There is a celebration of life and people that I find closer to the truth.
So this event upcoming at the Northwest Film Center, I believe it's April 10th. It's part of the What is Journalism Conference, which is put on by the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communications. That conference aims to answer questions about the changing nature of journalism. How does your project fit into these themes?
Well, I am a journalist, you know, again, a recovering one, but I think many people like me see their roles in a broader way than we used to. So it used to be the journalist that's the one telling the stories and giving voice to the voiceless. And the more I work with communities, the more I felt, you know what? Communities do have a voice. There are very few cases where I felt people are voiceless. What I felt is that we don't listen. So institutions don't listen, the broader community doesn't listen. So I think many of us, former journalists, or maybe people keep calling themselves journalists, can see themselves as facilitator of other type of storytelling. Now, is it journalism? We can debate on what journalism is supposed to be. We can talk about objectivity. I don't believe in it. I don't think many people can still kind of swear about their own objectivity. But we can talk about the function of journalism. And to me, it's about democracy and inclusion. And so in that case, yes, the Vampire Multimedia Project is journalism. And it's about really the needs of a community. Is this story told? It's not. It's not in the way that it should. So, yes, let's call it journalism.
Yeah. And you're only one of several people involved with the screening and discussion. There are others who will be part of the panel that are doing similar participatory work. What else can you tell us about the event?
Well, it's going to be amazing. Not because of me participating, but I'm really looking forward to kind of the perspectives of the other presenters. Elaine McMillian, she's going to present her project Hollow, which is about rural America, and it's, again, told through the eyes and voices of those living in rural America. Michael Primo with the Sandy Storylines, and those are stories of ongoing recovery from Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. And then the panel moderator is Jigar Mehta, who maybe people know for the 18 days in Egypt, which was an interactive storytelling website documenting a year of revolution in Egypt. Again, these are all people who are pushing the envelope in how journalists and storytellers work with community to tell the story together. It's not all stories should be told this way. So as much as I believe in participatory media, I'm not saying that this is the way to tell stories. But there's definitely times where working with communities in a more inclusive way brings a different layer of stories.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I've been speaking with Laura Loforti. She is the program director of the Vanport Multimedia Project. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Jen. You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'm on the line right now with Todd Darling. He's the director of the new documentary, Occupy the Farm, which is coming to Portland in the next few days. And Todd, welcome back to KBOO.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
We had you on when you were in town back in 2008. Your documentary was A Snowmobile for George, about two-stroke engines. And now this new documentary is a real labor of love. This started out about 3 years ago.
Yeah, that's correct. Occupy the Farm is about 200 urban farmers who, on April 22nd of 2012,
Earth Day,
walked onto a publicly owned research farm with 15,000 seedlings and planted 2 acres of crops in order to save this land from becoming a real estate development.
And this was known as the Gill Tract. It's administered by the University of California at Berkeley, and it's been a research farm for nearly a century. It's part of its mission was to be agricultural land, and it had never been developed.
No, this land had never been anything but a farm, and before that, just, you know, nature. The University of California is a land-grant college, and there are land-grant colleges in all 50 states. Land-grant colleges were set up during the Civil War. In fact, the charter for the University of California at Berkeley is signed by Abraham Lincoln. And all of the state congressional representatives were given a certain amount of land that they could use to build universities or to finance universities, so long as universities were open to the public, to anyone who could, you know, qualify to get in, and as long as they taught agriculture and mechanical arts. So in this case, University of California, Berkeley is required to teach agriculture as it's part of its founding charter, and the Gill Tract is its last farm anywhere close to campus. So the university was in a position that was contradictory to its own charter, and they've been negotiating with people in the community to try to avert the development. Nothing had happened, and then on April 22nd, 2012, 200 people took the matter into their own hands.
So here you are. You're getting a text on your phone from some of these urban farmers who recognize your work, and they're asking you to come right out and start documenting this process.
Well, it wasn't quite as simple as that. A friend of mine had introduced me to urban farmers in Oakland. We tried to develop something for television about urban farming in Oakland, and I'd gotten acquainted with all the issues about food deserts, the scarcity of food in poor urban neighborhoods, which is a problem that stretches across the United States. And nothing ever happened. That idea just died a hideous death. And a few months after that, the Occupy movement started up, and I was in Oakland, out in front of City Hall, and we recognized some of the same farmers that we'd met doing the research earlier were running the kitchen at Occupy the Farm. And it suddenly struck me that urban farmers who face a scarcity of land and the Occupy movement were natural allies, and that sooner or later they would get together and they would do something. And that would be a great story. That would be a movie. So I sort of put the word out to my friends that I wanted to make a film like this, that I expected something like this was going to happen. And then basically 6 months later, I got the text saying that this action was taking place, and we got cameras over there right away. So we just ran over there and started making a film. And 2.5 years later, it was on the screen.
Well, in the film, you get some amazing access to various players in what turns out to be quite a drama. You talk to many of the professors and administrators at the University of California, Berkeley, and members of the community. And there's high drama with the city council people in Albany because this encroaches on their territory as well.
Yeah, it's within the city of Albany, and a square mile tucked in between Berkeley and Richmond. The zoning issues, like whether or not the land could be zoned, could be taken out of its agricultural public purpose use and put into development, had to be approved by the city of Albany. And you're right, there was an amazing amount of drama considering the sort of the hyper-local nature of the story. This fight over this one piece of land wound up being very emblematic. The battle for the land really did seesaw back and forth and would take unexpected turns, sometimes multiple unexpected turns in the same day. And everybody following this story was just amazed at how it just kept going. It just didn't stop. And all this stuff happened, in front of our cameras. It was kind of amazing.
There were some strange moments, almost unreal moments, as this battle ramped up and got more and more epic. At one point, the university cuts off the water supply. So you have supporters of the urban farmers bringing in water by foot.
Yeah, this was an amazing development. The occupation took place. People walked on with all these seedlings and started to plant up their place. There was a source of water. There was spigots, the hoses, and after a couple of days, the university turned the water off, thinking that that would deter the efforts to farm. But instead, what happened was that dozens of people in the neighborhood volunteered their hoses. So pretty soon, there was about 50 different houses that were donating water. Several people with trucks, several sets of tanks that people had just donated to the project, and they were driving tanks of water onto the farm, and then people were taking gallon buckets, basically plastic water bottles, and going out and watering 2 acres of crops by hand. And this went on for weeks, and the organizing around the water sort of wound up being one of the central organizing principles of the farm, and it wound up bringing in all kinds of people from the community. So the simple pursuit of water became really a unifying factor.
Well, I'm not going to give away any spoilers, but I will mention that there are some amazing twists and turns. There's the promise of student housing, of low-income housing. There's the promise of a Whole Foods there. There's all of these other big ideas for genetically modified crops, things like that.
Yeah, this piece of land, it was purchased by the university from a nursery, from a farm, to be the research farm for UC Berkeley. But at this point, there's sort of three competing visions for this land. Either this land was going to become a real estate development to bring some money in for the cash-strapped university, or it was going to be used for corn gene research that is used principally for companies like Monsanto and energy companies like British Petroleum, or it could be used for agricultural research for the public good more generally, specifically in this era for urban agriculture. And so these three competing visions really came to bear during this time, and it was amazing to watch it all unfold. And that's why I say, like, this one piece of land wound up being very consequential, being very focused on, you know, what is the future of public resources in the United States? What's the future of research on a public university? And what's the future of food?
Well, clearly, getting the word out to the community and to the public, to the media, was a huge step in making sure that the Occupy the Farm movement was able to keep going. You know, the police seemed to take a step back when they saw how much support was going towards the farm movement.
Well, there was a couple of funny things that sort of happened. I mean, you have to remember that this happened, or not even 6 months after Occupy Oakland was finally put down. So people were still, I mean, literally, people were still in the hospital recovering from police injuries. The police had been sued by lots of people for various things. And there was just a sort of a heightened feeling of awareness about this. So the police were sort of, you know, they were moving a little bit more cautiously at this point because the press had been so bad regarding police suppression of Occupy. And then this, the sort of hopeful nature of what Occupy the Farm was doing was inspiring. I mean, you know, there's little kids out planting zucchini. I mean, you know, so we're going to have, how are the police going to go chase children and families around a field who are planting seedlings? It was like, what are they doing that's wrong? You know, this is public land. This is, you know, it's been part of the community for quite a while. So those two things, the sort of hopeful nature of the action and the after effects of Occupy, kind of conspired to give this action some space in order for it to take off, and drew in a lot of people.
Well, the documentary Occupy the Farm is coming to the Clinton Street Theater, Portland's century-old cinema, for a three-day run. That's March 31st through April 2nd. And the director, Todd Darling, that's you. You're going to be coming to Portland for a Q&A.
Yes, I will be in Portland for the Q&A on April 2nd. And there's going to be panel discussions each evening after the screening. Right now, it looks like there's going to be one on the social justice, economic justice of urban farming the first night. The second night, April 1st, is going to be on the threats of development and other things to farmland. And then the last night was going to be me, as well as a panel discussing bees and pollinators and the threats to them, as bees have had a hard time surviving of late. So, discussions afterwards have been really lively, and the connections that people make and what's discussed has been really interesting.
So there's more information available at the Clinton Street Theater website, which is cstpdx.com. And if people miss the screenings of Occupy the Farm, they can go to your website. There might be a DVD coming out soon?
Yeah, we're going to probably do some kind of streaming, probably sometime after the theatrical run, May, June, something like that. But still a bit uncertain, but eventually.
Has there been any interest from some of the cable channels or from some of the festivals around the country?
Well, it's actually this weekend. I'm going to the Princeton Environmental Film Festival, and last weekend it showed at the Paradigm Shifts Film Festival on Manhattan. It showed at Big Sky. It showed at Wild and Scenic. And as far as getting on the television, it's important that the documentary be seen in theaters and that that it becomes, you know, something that people talk about. So supporting the theaters of any film, particularly this film, definitely helps to get it on the television. And I should just say that if people want to know what's happening at the Gilletract Farm right now, they can go to the film's website, or they can also go to the farmer's website, which is occupythefarm.org, and find out what's going on, because things are still happening.
And the website for the documentary is?
The website for the documentary is occupythefarmfilm.com. also Occupy the Farm film on Facebook.
Well, Todd, darling, we'll look forward to seeing you in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on April 2nd. Thank you for coming back on KBOO again and talking about your work.
Oh, my pleasure entirely. Thanks very much for having me on, and thanks for all the good work you guys do.
You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Konser. Now let's go out to the monthly calendar of film events with Jen Chavez.
Here's some local film events coming up in the next month. Tonight, Thursday the 26th, the Academy Theater will host the Portland premiere of Mateo in conjunction with the Media Institute for Social Change. The documentary follows a redheaded American gringo who becomes fascinated with mariachi music in prison and goes on to pursue a dream of being the world's most famous white mariachi player, traveling to Cuba to play music. Both the director and the film's subject will be in attendance for a pre-film performance and post-film Q&A. More info at academytheaterpdx.com. The Cinescopio screening series, devoted this year to classic Mexican actor Pedro Infante in conjunction with Fusion Arte, continues at the Hollywood Theater this month. This Saturday, March 28th, his comedy ATM a Todo Máquina screens matinee at 2 p.m. And on April 15th at 7:30 p.m., they'll screen Pepe el Toro, the final film in a saga following that character, a Mexican working-class hero. More info at hollywoodtheater.org. On April 3rd through 5th, the Faux Film Festival is coming to a close after a 10-year run with 3 days of Faux Film Festival favorites at the Clinton Street Theater. Two blocks of films each night start at 7 p.m., featuring a collection of favorite Faux commercials and trailers, spoofs, satires, parodies, and mockumentaries. Details at fauxfilm.com. And on April 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, KBOO's own film series continues with Charles Lloyd, Arrows into Infinity, at 7 p.m. The music documentary chronicles the life and work of the influential jazz player. More info at cstpdx.com. From April 9th through the 12th, the Hollywood Theater will be home to the Portland Eco Film Festival, showcasing feature and short films about the environment, nature conservation, outdoor adventure, agriculture, and community wellness, featuring visiting filmmakers, an opening night party at VeloCult, a nature and stop-motion animation workshop for kids, and more. Details at portlandecofilmfest.org. On April 17th, the Northwest Film Center presents An Evening with Kelly Sears, featuring a program of Kelly's experimental collage animation work beginning at 7 p.m. The next day, the 18th, she'll also conduct the workshop Bigfoot Reinterpreted, a community stop-motion animation project, from 10 to 2. More info at northwestfilmcenter.org. On April 17th at the Clinton Street Theater, local film collective Cinema Project presents Horrorism for Beginners, Beginners for Horrorism at 7:30 p.m. The Berlin-based collective OJOBOCA will present a selection of films and projector performances that demonstrate their practice of horrorism, or, quote, a simulated method of inner and outer transformation. Filmmakers from the collective will also conduct a Northwest Film Center School of Film workshop on the 19th from 10 to 5, Indirect Contact, Printing Images and Objects onto 16mm Film. More details at cinemaproject.org. And another Cinema Project event, this time on April 30th, Frameless Continuum, Image Processing in Early American Video Art. The 7:30 p.m. screening at PNCA's Media Tech will feature short works from the 1970s and 80s. Details at cinemaproject.org. Well, that about wraps it up. Have a great month, everybody.
Thank you, Jen. And thanks to our guests today. Laura Loforti joined us from the Vanport Multimedia Project. And Todd Darling called in. He'll be at the Clinton Street Theater on April 2nd for a screening of Occupy the Farm. Thanks, as always, to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration, and thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at KBOO Film Show. I'm SW Conser. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, March 26, 2015. Aircraft from a coalition of Arab nations attacked rebel-controlled Yemeni military bases today as part of an ongoing fight with the Houthi forces. Houthi, who U.S. officials say have an affiliation with al-Qaeda, drove Yemen's president out of the capital city, Sana'a, by boat on Wednesday. The coalition of Arab nations loyal to the Yemeni government is led by Saudi Arabia and includes Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. The attacks killed 28 people, including children, and injured another 55, some of them critically. While U.S. forces are not taking part in the actions, they are providing logistical and intelligence support. Meanwhile, in Iraq, a Shia military commander has asked the U.S. to cease airstrikes on the city of Tikrit. Hadi al-Amiri, who is leading a group of militias in a fight against the Islamic State forces in the city, said that the airstrikes were not helping and that he had no direct contact with U.S. forces. The announcement came just hours after the Iraqi government called on the U.S. for more airstrikes. The U.S. and Arab forces have launched more than 2,000 airstrikes against IS in Iraq and Syria since August. Today, Oregon lawmakers introduced a bill into the Senate that would require background checks on private gun sales. Previously, people that bought guns on the internet or from private individuals were exempt from background checks. Under the bill, sales of guns to law enforcement or back to the original owners, or sales between family members, would be exempt. The bill would also ban the sale of guns to individuals under outpatient treatment for mental health if there was a likelihood that they would hurt themselves or others.